All right, so this is about 2:41, and it's Tuesday, September 16th, and we're starting chapter 6. And the next test, I believe, is going to cover chapters 4, 5, and 6. So we've covered 4, and we're going to 6, and then we're going to go back and do 5, and then I think it'll be set for the next test. But please come to class to find out if that schedule changes, but that's what it looks like for now. Okay, and talking about tests, you'll get them back tonight in lab. Some of you have seen your tests already. You might want to look it over once again. Don't take any notes or anything on the test, but review those questions and see if there's some kind of common theme mistake that you're making. There are a couple people that left answers blank. Always put answers in. And before you turn your Scantron in, check every single line. Make sure you're not leaving something blank on the test. And let's see, what's important for the test? Well, for sure, all of the questions that are in the study guide, you should review to work with the information in these chapters. So there's web questions, and there's questions at the end of the chapter, and maybe you have to spend some time. It might take maybe 2 or 3 hours to go through all those questions the first time. All right, and then the second time you go through them, it might take only 1.5 hours. And then the third time you go through them, it should only take like 40 minutes. And then the third time, maybe 10 minutes. And then the fourth or fifth time, you know, maybe even 5 or 10 minutes to go through all those questions. And there are a lot of times I like to take some questions and lift them right off of the web or from the back of the book. And that would make the test real easy for you. But it just covers the information that we're covering in lecture. All right, so what else is important for tests? Exam figures. Right, make sure you print those exam figures out and practice labeling them. And then if I ever have any flash quizzes, review the flash quizzes because you can cover a lot of information like we did for chemical structure last time. And then, of course, the notes. Maybe you could rewrite your notes or relook at the PowerPoints again or something. That all would help. And, of course, read the chapter. And the reason why Professor Spooner and I selected this textbook, because we had a lot of requests from students for this particular textbook because it was so easy to read compared to the other ones. I think I like some of the other ones a little bit better, their organization, but students said it was just too hard to read. So please read the chapters in here. It's one of the reasons why we got this book, because it was recommended by students, was recommended by you guys, basically. Okay, so that gives you some hints. But you could always talk to me about your study plan and talk to Dr. Ogoshi with you about your study plan and what to study. And if you have questions or whatever, certainly you should talk to him too. Okay? So those are just some thoughts I have in general. But if you have specific questions and I would like to get together with you, come to my office sometime and I'll look at your Scantron and I'll look at the test and see what areas you're a little deficient in and make some suggestions, but I also want to look at your study plan. Even if you haven't taken the time to plan it out a week ahead of time, every time you study, you should mark on your study plan that you are studying that amount of time. Even before class, you might study for 5 or 10 minutes with students. That's probably, you might actually learn a lot studying as a group, even just for 15 or 20 minutes before class. So if you want to form a study group before class, just talk to some people and say, hey, let's get together before class and talk about some stuff. That's probably handy. All right, so that's just some random thoughts that I have. And some students did excellently, and some did good, and some did okay, and some did poor, and it all depends. I can't say how the class in general is going because it's just all very individual. It's all up to the individual, what their background is and all that kind of stuff. So those are just some thoughts I have. Anybody have any particular questions regarding the test? No? Okay. All right, well, let's move on to our next chapter. So we're going to define extracellular environment. We have done that already, but we'll just reintroduce that. We'll talk about movement across a plasma membrane. So we're going to talk about transport processes across the cell membrane. And that's actually going to include osmosis and some particular transport systems, some proteins that are necessary. And we're going to begin to talk about membrane potential and how cells signal each other in this particular chapter. right? And a membrane potential, I tell you what, when you see this word potential, now's a good time to define what that means. Potential. All right, I got my arrow back. When you see this word potential right here, does anybody have a feel for what that means, really? Potential. Membrane potential. Has something to do with the membrane. Something about the membrane. What about the membrane when we say membrane potential? What are we actually thinking about? What it has the ability to do. Yeah, the potential for it to do something. And it has even a little bit more special and specific sense. When we say potential, that's just another word for voltage. It's the ability to do something electrically or electronically. And that's one thing you might find very strange in this class, and that is living systems are very electrical in their basic nature. And we're going to see where that electricity comes from. But you already probably have a little hint where it comes from. Where does electricity come from in our bodies? We look at something. We look at some molecules that had enzymes. So pretty good guess, but I wouldn't go that way. Okay, cells. Yeah, cells are electrical, but what kind of molecules in cells give cells electrical activity? Ions. It's those molecules that have electrical charge, either positive charges or negative charges. Those are the things that cells manipulate to create voltages and currents, and we're going to see a membrane potential results or a membrane voltage results as occurs because of different ions in our body. And we learned how to form ions, right? If I gave you potassium, well, you could look at the periodic table if I uncovered it and drew out the protons and the electrons and figure out where these electrons are going to go to make ions. So that was pretty important for us to look at. All right, so getting to this chapter, we have the extracellular environment. So what the heck is the extracellular environment? That is everything that's outside of the cell. So with using the same kind of nomenclature, what would we call everything that is inside the cell? You could say cytoplasm, and you're right, but that's not necessarily what I mean. What I really mean is what? The intracellular compartment, right? So we have the extracellular compartment and the extracellular compartment. And 60% of the total body, water, is inside cells. That would be the intracellular compartment. 33% is outside the cells. That's extracellular. So most of the water is inside our cells. And if we think of the extracellular compartment, which is what we're going to call ECF, extracellular fluid, that's what that F stands for, that makes up the extracellular compartment, 20% of it is blood plasma, and 80%, which is the remainder, is just interstitial fluid. That's fluid between the cells, but not in a blood vessel anywhere, right? And that fluid dissolves some proteins, some glycoproteins, and makes a gel out of it. And so we say that this water is contained in a gel-like matrix between cells. But that water can diffuse and flow very slowly around all cells of the body through this gel-like matrix, which in some tissues we call ground substance. Maybe you've heard of that term, ground substance, when we talked about connective tissue in anatomy. Okay, so that's where that water is. All right, now what about blood plasma? I don't know if you have a picture of blood in your mind. What are the components of blood? If we take blood out of somebody, what do we call that tissue that we actually take out with a syringe? A phlebotomist. Okay? The blood that we actually drain out of somebody in a syringe is what we call whole blood, right? Because it's a complete blood connective tissue. We just stick a needle in a vein and draw that blood out. That's whole blood. So what is whole blood composed of? Can you compartmentalize it? It is what? Plasma. That's part of it. And red blood cells, that's part of it. That's part of it. And platelets, that's the other part of it. But if we put red blood cells, white blood cells, and platelets all together, we call these things formed elements. Right? Formed elements. So formed elements really means what? Cells. And plasma really means what? The fluid part. So that's where that comes from on this slide, the fluid part of blood. So you can separate blood into formed elements and plasma. Furthermore, you can separate formed elements into what? You said RBCs, WBCs, and platelets. That's not so important for this class, but you should probably know that already anyway, right? Okay. What's the real name for an RBC? Red blood cell. But what's the real name for a red blood cell? Erythrocyte. Cyte means cell. Erythro means red. And what's the real name for a WBC? Leukocyte. So cyte means cell. Leuko means white. Like, what's the scientific name for the animal symbol of the United States of America? Well, what is the symbol of the United States of America? Pull out a $20 bill. Take a look. What's on there? You don't have a 20? You guys. I'm out, too. That's good you don't, because I'd ask for it. But anyway, it's a bald eagle, right? It's an eagle. You all know what a bald eagle sort of looks like? Well, the scientific name for bald eagle is leucocephalus. Cephalus means toward the head. You learn that in anatomy, and leuco just means white. So leukocyte. And what's the real name for a platelet? That's a thrombocyte. So erythrocyte, leukocyte, thrombocyte. Those all make the formed elements in blood. Okay, so that's these are the parts, the compartments that things can move around in, can diffuse in our body. So things can diffuse, a molecule can diffuse through a gas, like air in the room. Things can diffuse through a liquid, and that's why we're talking about these liquids right here. But things cannot diffuse through a solid material, like these tabletops right here, okay, because it's just too dense for material to diffuse through it. But things can diffuse through fluid and through gas, and that's probably one of the reasons why our body is made up of so much fluid, so that things can move around inside our body. All right, the extracellular matrix is a meshwork of collagen and elastic fibers linked to molecules of this gel-like ground substance and to plasma membranes. So, for instance, here we have, this looks like a little blood vessel, blood capillary, and I see a couple cells here and here in this connective tissue, and then we see, what does this kind of look like to you? Oh, it says. That's an epithelium, right? So an epithelium does what? It covers a surface or lines a cavity, and you can see the nice basement membrane right here. And there are certain kinds of molecules in the plasma membranes of these cells, which are what? Glycoproteins. And these glycoproteins are connected to the collagen and elastic fibers in the ground substance right here. So your body really is all connected to each other by these kinds of fibers. But don't forget, we have water in here that solubilizes that ground substance. So things can diffuse through this extracellular matrix because it's a fluid in nature, right? It's a fluid. But nonetheless, it's pretty stable because of all these different fibers. And that interstitial fluid resides in a hydrated gel of ground substance. So this is sort of like, you know, like I guess like jello or jelly or something, the ground substance. But nonetheless, it's not a solid. It's a semi-liquid or semi-solid, so things can move through it. Okay. Well, what about the plasma membrane? Things can move through that ground substance, but things can also have to get in and out of the cell. And the cell membrane is what we call selectively permeable. And what the heck does that mean? There's another term for it, too. A selectively permeable membrane, like the cell membrane, will allow certain molecules to go through, but not all kinds of molecules. And if we have a cell membrane right here, how would you think about any kind of membrane? What would be how could you describe the internal structure of any kind of membrane, cell membrane? What's the basic building block of a cell membrane? Yeah, phospholipid, right? So the best way to talk about a membrane is that, how many layers is it? It's two. Phospholipid bilayer, right, is the best way to think of a membrane. So we have a bunch of phospholipids like this. And these little tails are what kind of molecules? Polar or nonpolar? Or hydrophilic or hydrophobic? This region right here. So this is hydrophobic, right? Hydrophobic. Hydrophobic. Okay. So that just means that lipid-soluble compounds can move across the membrane because that's the kind of compound that can dissolve in this hydrophobic region. But any kind of hydrophilic compound, like an ion, can't get across the membrane because it can't get through this barrier right here. So water really can't get across the membrane. Ions can't get across. But of course, if it's a living cell, under certain conditions, these things do have to move back and forth. And I'll show you how that happens in just a little bit. So some things can move across the membrane, but not everything. And maybe at certain times, some things can move through, and at other times, they can't move through. So selectively permeable just means that some molecules can move across, like what kind of molecules? Hydrophobic or nonpolar? Molecules can, but other kinds of molecules can't. They get bounced out. They can't get through this hydrophobic region. So these are what? Polar compounds or hydrophilic. Hydrophilic compounds can't. So this membrane really is a barrier. It separates the outside world from the inside world. And it's the job of the living cell to control what gets in and what gets out and all that kind of stuff. So if a molecule can't get through the membrane because it's polar or hydrophilic, and the cell needs to move it one way or the other, it can actually build certain kinds of proteins and insert them into the plasma membrane. And these things are what we call transporters or channels. So a cell can, for instance, build a protein, insert it into the membrane, like this, all right, and now we see what? A little passageway through the membrane. That's what we call a channel. And sometimes the cell has the channel open, other times it has the channel closed. So if there's a little gate that can open or close, we call that a gated channel. We're going to learn about some gated channels. So some of these processes for moving things across the membrane are what we call carrier-mediated transport. That involves a specific protein transporter. And some are non-carrier-mediated transport. That just means that there is a little tunnel or channel through the membrane, and the substance can just move across the membrane through that little passageway. But if this protein isn't here, what happens? It gets blocked by this hydrophobic region right here. Okay. So how can a molecule move across this membrane from one side or the other through this channel? And on the slide, it tells you by diffusion. All right, so we're going to consider diffusion for just a little bit. And I think you already had a lab on diffusion, right? But let's just review it real quick anyway. Okay, so generally speaking, things can cross a membrane or be transported across a membrane by two different mechanisms. These are the two most general ways to think about it. The first is a passive transport mechanism, and the second is an active transport mechanism. And a passive transport mechanism has a couple connotations or a couple criteria, but probably the most important is this last one over here. A passive mechanism does not require any energy. That means that it's going to happen all by itself. Okay, doesn't need any energy. And in the cell, where would a process get energy from if energy was required? ATP. It's going to be from a molecule called ATP, and you're probably a little familiar with what ATP looks like. Right? An active transport process requires energy in the form of ATP to move something. Now, how can it move? If it's passive, things can move down a concentration gradient. Now, what do we mean by concentration gradient? It means from high to low. So if I were to draw on this board right here two areas, and this board is pretty marked up, but I think I can do it anyway. All right, I'm going to draw some. Oh, here, let me just say and give you another little foundation of something. Hold on, I got to sneeze. Ah, it's going away. Okay. Thank you. All right, so here we have, now don't forget, we're going to be talking about water environments, like inside our cell. That's why we started talking about these different compartments. So a water environment is going to be a solution of stuff. And what the heck is a solution? I'm not sure I wrote this on the board yet in here. It is what? A solvent plus a solute. All right, so it's got these two compartments. So always in this class, it's so important to know the building blocks of things. So the building block of a solution is what? The liquid part and then the stuff that's dissolved in it, the solute. Solvent and the solute. Okay, so I'm going to talk about, just pretend this board right here is all water, and I'm going to put some solutes on the board, like salt or glucose or something like that. And here are some solutes over here, and here are some solutes over here. Can you tell which one is more concentrated? On the, I guess I'll just label this A and B. What's more concentrated in what molecule? Solute. You see a difference? I meant there to not be a difference. So the concentration over here at A is pretty much the same as B over here. All right, so there is no concentration gradient. It's the same concentration. So let's make a concentration gradient. Let's make this what? More concentrated in solute. All right, there are just more particles that are dissolved in solution. So can you see that B is more concentrated than A? Yeah. And because the concentration in B is different than A, we say there is a gradient in concentration. And we could graph this, so we could draw a graph. All right, so this could be concentration. Oh, I'm running out of room. Concentration versus distance right here, and we can say this is point A and here's point B, and if we draw it, we see the concentration at A is really low, but by the time we get to B, it's what? High? All right, so it's really high, so that looks like a hill or a slope or something that looks like a gradient right there. So that's what we mean by gradient. So which way can things diffuse? Down a concentration gradient. So things will diffuse which way? From A to B or B to A? From B to A. They will always be going what? Down that concentration gradient. Does not require energy. So if I had a perfume bottle right here, I open up the perfume bottle and there's no perfume in the room, right? The perfume would evaporate, and even though there's no fans in the room, would that perfume move all by itself? You're right. It sure would. What word would you use to describe that motion of the perfume through the room? We call that diffusion. So things are going to move according to their concentration gradient. So high here in the front, very low in the back, perfume is just going to move through the room. And if we come back in the morning and the concentration is the same in the front as in the back, when we get here after a long period of time, is that perfume molecule going to move? After a long period of time. Oh, I'm getting high smelling the marker. I'm going to cover it up. Okay. So after a long period of time, when the perfume concentration is uniform through the whole room, is any diffusion taking place? You know what? Molecules are moving around, but there is no net motion. So as soon as the concentration gradient goes away, it flattens out, diffusion actually stops. There has to be a concentration gradient from point A to point B for things to move around. If the concentration is the same, no diffusion. It stops. Okay. Now, active transport is possible, but things can actually go from a low concentration to high. What would that be like for the perfume bottle? Say we left the perfume bottle open all night, came back. There's perfume all the way around in the room. But now we did something to have an active process. What would happen to the perfume? It would all jump back in the bottle. Okay, would that happen automatically? No, that doesn't happen automatically. You need to put energy in. And you have to develop some kind of machine to go grab the perfume and put it in the bottle. But somebody figured that out already. So all you have to do is what? Go to the store and buy a bottle of perfume. You don't have to figure out how to do that yourself. But it would require energy to put all that perfume in a concentrated form inside that bottle. So your body can do that with active transport mechanisms, but it requires ATP, right? So passive can go from high to low, no energy. Active processes can move things up a concentration gradient, but to move things up, you need ATP to do that. All right. Anybody have a question on that? Maybe. All right, I'll give you one more example. Okay, when I was in college, I had this car. And it was, I think, a 1968 MGB. A little Ford. It was about as big as this desk right here. It was very efficient. It was made in England, and they didn't know how to make cars very well. Okay. So every couple of weeks, it would break down for some reason. The battery was dead, or the starter motor wouldn't work. Right. So I get done with school after lab, like around 9 o'clock, try to go home, and the car wouldn't start. So I learned. What would I do? I would park my car on top of a hill. Okay? Because why? Because all I had to do is sit down in the car, and it was a really small car, and put my little leg out the door and give it a little kick, and I could start rolling down the hill and pop the clutch and start the engine, and then I could go home. So that was really nice. So does it take any energy for this car to roll down the hill, to go from high to low? No. That's passive, right? Because gravity was pulling the car down. Didn't need energy to do that. All right, so this is the passive process. But what about getting my car up the hill? What's that? Going from low to high. What does that require? Yeah, that requires energy, gasoline in the car, but in you, it's ATP. So this is what? The active process. All right, so don't ever get that mixed up. Passive, active, high to low. Okay. All right, so let's look at diffusion. And here we have a solution. And I would guess this background right here is just water, and then these particles right here are solute particles. And we have a high concentration here. Do you see that? It's really concentrated with solutes. And it's low concentration over here. So these molecules are going to be moving around, and you're going to have more motion from left to right than from right to left. Some of these molecules on the lower concentration will move over here, but many, many more are going to move in the opposite direction. So we call that the net diffusion. So they're going to subtract from each other. The net diffusion will bring molecules, solute molecules, to the right. And after a long period of time, what do you see? What can you tell me about the concentration in these two compartments? They're equal. And when they're equal, what happens to the net diffusion? The amount going to the left is equal to the amount going to the right, so the net diffusion actually goes to zero as a result of that. So the driving force for diffusion is what? The concentration gradient. Okay. Now in lab you learned a nice equation for diffusion. Your body uses diffusion all the time. So here's a living cell. In order for this living cell to make ATP, it needs oxygen. So how does the oxygen get inside the cell? It gets in by just simply by diffusion, because there's high oxygen concentration in the air and there's low oxygen in the cells. So that's the concentration gradient. And just by breathing, we get oxygen into our body. It's transported by a circulatory system. And oxygen leaves the blood and it goes to that cell just because of diffusion. No special kinds of things are necessary. Cells then produce CO2. And how does CO2 leave your body? By diffusion. Because the concentration of CO2 in the air, the normal air, is almost zero. It's like 0.03%. All right? And your cells are producing CO2. CO2 is going to just move out of your body by diffusion. Nothing special is required. So that's how gas exchange takes place. Okay, I was going to write something on the board. Might come back to me, it might not. Okay, so let's talk about diffusion some more. Here we have a nice phospholipid bilayer. This is a membrane, right? And here we have some, let's just call these charged particles or polar particles. Can they get through the membrane by themselves? No way, right? So they need some kind of channel. Here is a protein. Oh, what's a good model to think of a plasma membrane that has all these other components in it, like integrins and channels and antigens and things like that? We use the first model to describe what? That a membrane is a phospholipid bilayer, but in real life, it's not just a simple phospholipid bilayer. The fluid mosaic model is the best way to think of a membrane, because we insert other kinds of structural proteins that have a function. So there's going to be a relationship between the structure of the membrane and the function that is going on at the same time. So this is actually a channel for maybe an ion that's charged, which is what? A polar compound when it's charged. Can't get through the membrane. And this channel can open and can close, and it can control the diffusion of this particular solute depending on conditions inside the cell. All right, so charged molecules must have an ion channel or a transporter to move across the membrane. Oh, I know what I was thinking of. Okay, so the rate of diffusion. This slide is a little imperfect, but we can make it better pretty easily. You should be familiar with what the rate of diffusion is. That means what? The speed of diffusion, how fast diffusion occurs. All right, so what is the most important thing for diffusion? Is the, they got it right here on the slide, it's the concentration gradient, right? When that goes away, diffusion stops. The bigger the concentration gradient also means the faster it will go, right? All right, also the permeability of the membrane. So we're talking about diffusion through a membrane. If the membrane is impermeable, then diffusion cannot take place. But if it's highly permeable, then it doesn't act like a barrier at all, and it can move through. Temperature is important. That's actually how molecules can move around, by diffusion. So here's a molecule. Who's this? Who's that? That's water. Okay. Now that's a pretty poor picture of water. Okay, it's just a still picture. If we were actually going to make some kind of picture of water, what's the best? What would be the best way to make a picture of this water molecule? I don't think anybody could read my mind on this one. So I'm going to have to tell you. Okay. The best way to put a picture of this water molecule would be actually to put it on YouTube. What do we have on YouTube? Videos. The best way to really represent this molecule here is make a video of it, because the water molecule is not just stationary, it's not just sitting someplace. It's always in motion, it's moving around. And it's vibrating all the time. It's vibrating and twisting and rotating and turning, but mostly it's vibrating back and forth like this. And the degree of vibration or motion of the water molecule, or any molecule, is basically a measure of its temperature. So temperature is just a measure of how fast molecules are moving around. So if we decrease the temperature, we decrease the motion of this water molecule. And if we decrease the temperature a lot, what happens to the motion of this molecule? It slows down so much that what happens? It freezes. It forms a solid. Okay? But now let's go the other way. If we increase the motion of this water molecule, we can change it from ice to a liquid. Yeah, first a liquid, okay, because it jumps out of the solid. It's moving around so much it can't form a solid. And if you increase the temperature even further, it won't even stay in a liquid. What's it going to do? It's going to jump out of the liquid, right? It's going to boil. So temperature is just a measure of motion of a molecule, and that motion, that molecular motion, is what's causing diffusion, because it just acts like little stirs that are moving inside that fluid. So as the temperature increases, what happens to the motion of all molecules? It increases, and since the motion increases, so does the rate of diffusion. You can control diffusion by changing the temperature right here. All right, and then also the surface area of the membrane. As the membrane gets bigger, you can have more diffusion. So remember, surface area. What did I say that you should use in your mind as a construct for surface area in common everyday language?
Doorway.
As the doorway gets bigger, more molecules can move through it, right? Okay. And then lastly, what you learned in lab is the difference between, all right, here you have a stoplight. And here you got a motorcycle. And here you got a semi-tractor truck. And the light turns green. Which one is going to move away from the stoplight a lot faster? The motorcycle, because it's smaller. The same thing for diffusion. Okay, sorry, that's kind of, I guess, kind of like a guy's example. But anyway, you should all realize that the motorcycle can accelerate a lot faster than that big truck. The same thing for diffusion. The size of a molecule, we can quantify in a term by how heavy it is, and that is what? What's that? Did you see that in lab? That's the molecular weight, right? So the heavier, the bigger the molecular weight, the slower a molecule will diffuse. The smaller the molecule, the smaller the molecular weight, the faster it will diffuse. Okay. All right, so here is something that I want, some terminology that I want you to use. So temperature is really what? A measure of the motion of a compound. Okay. All right, so we're going to put rate of diffusion. All right, is equal to. Ooh, what does that mean? That means I'm going to talk mathematics right now. Okay? Okay, so let's get a little familiar with some terminology. But I'm going to put a fraction right here. So the rate of diffusion, okay, we said is somehow related to concentration gradient. As the concentration gradient goes up, what happens to the rate of diffusion? It goes up too. So did you have a letter for concentration gradient in lab? I don't want to pick a different one. So I'm just going to put what? I'll put a delta gradient. Okay? So we put the delta in the numerator, not the denominator. Because as this number here gets bigger, what then happens to the rate of diffusion? It increases too, right? If this number increases, then the rate of diffusion increases. Okay, what else we have? The gradient. What about temperature? We can put that here. As the temperature increases, what happens to the rate of diffusion? It increases too. Now, what about molecular weight? Where should we put molecular weight? As molecular weight increases, what happens to the rate of diffusion? It goes down. Do we put it in the numerator? No, we should not. We should put molecular weight in the denominator. And I think maybe I'll stop right there, but don't forget we got permeability here of the membrane, surface area of the membrane. But this is good enough for our example. So I'll put molecular weight right here. Now, how do we talk about these terms? And I will use this terminology in class quite a bit. You're probably all familiar with this. But I'm going to ask you, how is rate of diffusion related to the concentration gradient? And if it's in the numerator, we say it is directly related. Did you use these terms in lab? Maybe not. Directly related. And when I say it's directly related, that means what? If it's directly related, if one constant or variable increases, then the other one increases, right? They both go up. Now what about terms in the denominator here? You could say indirectly related, but that's not good. Okay, that's not quite mathematically correct. We say, somebody said it over here, it is inversely related, which means what? As molecular weight goes up, the rate of diffusion goes down. So I'm going to use directly related, inversely related all the time. If it's inversely related, just remember it goes in the opposite direction. You put it in the denominator over here. Okay. So that's real handy to be able to do that. All right, so what about diffusion? I think we're kind of done talking about diffusion. So what can diffuse? Water can diffuse, solutes can diffuse, gases can diffuse, but solids don't diffuse. Things can't diffuse through a solid. All right, now what about osmosis? That's important for biology because it is a kind of diffusion. So let's write down some criteria for osmosis. Osmosis is a kind of diffusion. All right, so osmosis, let's see. The first criteria is that it is diffusion. But if we say it like that, that means that you have to be educated on diffusion. What does diffusion really mean?
High to low.
High to low. High to low. And what about energy? No energy is required. Okay. So that's the first criteria for osmosis. Let's see if we have anything on the next slide. Okay. Here we see some compartment right here that's separated by a membrane. And I would say, I'm a little close to this slide, but I would say this area right here is a little bit more concentrated in solute. I see a few more particles over here than over here. So that means there's more water on the left-hand side than there is on the right-hand side. So a higher concentration water here, lower here, water is going to want to go from left to right, down its concentration gradient, not the gradient of the solute, but the concentration of the solvent molecule. And this particular membrane that we have has these little holes in it that allows these little molecules to go through, which are water. So water can go across the membrane, but the solute right here is too big to get through these pores. So here's a membrane that can let some substances through, but not everything. So what? How do we call this membrane? This is a semi-permeable or selectively permeable membrane, because it's letting something through, but not everything. Okay, and when that happens, so water is going to move from left to right, and is going to try to equal out its concentration on both sides of this membrane right over here. All right, and because these solutes can't move across this selectively permeable membrane, we say that these solutes are osmotically active, because they can, when, for instance, when water moves over here, what happens to the volume of this chamber? When water goes from left to right, the volume of this chamber goes down because water is leaving. What happens to the volume of this chamber here? It increases, right? And it's actually going to rise up the beaker. All right? And so that happens because this solute right here can't get across the membrane. If it could get across the membrane, then the volumes wouldn't change. Both would equalize and no volume would change. But the volume is going to change, so we say these solutes are osmotically active. They're going to cause this volume to increase while this one to decrease because of a selectively permeable membrane. All right, so a second criteria for osmosis is that there has to be a selectively permeable membrane, and I'm just going to put semi-permeable. That's number two. And then number three, the thing that is diffusing is, in this example over here, what's diffusing? Going from high concentration to low?
Water.
And what is water? What is water with our definition right here? The solvent. Right? So specifically in biological systems, osmosis is the movement of water. I'm going to put H2O right here. Through a semi-permeable membrane, moving from high concentration to low without energy. That's really a nice, strict definition of osmosis. But don't forget, if you're doing some chemistry someplace, it doesn't have to necessarily be water. It could be any solvent. Does anybody else have any other kind of solvents that they've used besides water? Probably. Like acetone. What's acetone a solvent for? Yeah, it's fingernail polish remover. That's what fingernail polish is dissolved in, right? So depending on what kind of chemistry you're doing, right, you can have different solvents. But in us, what is our solvent? It's water. Okay. So that is osmosis. Okay. So something is osmotically active if what? If it cannot freely move across the membrane. Okay. Then it is osmotically active. Yeah, we're going to look and see what happens. Really drastic things can happen to a cell, because what is a cell surrounded by? A selectively permeable membrane. Okay, it's a cell is surrounded by a membrane, and some things can go through and other things can't. And that's going to have some drastic consequences to a cell, depending on the concentration of water across that membrane. All right, so let's look at another condition right here. So here we have kind of an imaginary system, and so we have two volumes. What's the relationship between these two volumes right here? How do they look? Does one look bigger than the other? The volume of this one and the volume of this one? Okay, when I look at it, they look the same to me. Like this length right here looks like this length, and the height is equal to this height, and the depth is equal to this depth. That's how we would calculate the volume. So the volume of these two compartments look the same. So we're just going to say X right at the beginning of the experiment. But what about the concentration of solute? On the left-hand side, we mixed up a solution that has 180 grams of glucose per liter. And on the right-hand side, it's what? It's twice that, right? So the compartment on the right has a lot less water. It's much more concentrated in solute. So in terms of water, water has a higher concentration on the left, lower on the right. So which way is water going to move? Down its concentration gradient, right, from high to low, which means from left to right. And this membrane right here is semi-permeable. It's not going to let these solutes move through, right? So this is would this satisfy the definition of osmosis? Water will diffuse through that selectively permeable membrane. Those solutes can't move, and it's what? The water molecule that's moving through. All right, so then we'll turn time on and let water osmose through the membrane. So water is going to leave the left-hand compartment and move into the right. That means it's got to push the membrane over, right? Because this volume is getting bigger, right? Based on the difference in concentration on either side of this membrane. Now, water, you know, is a polar compound. How can it get through a plasma membrane with this big hydrophobic region? There has to be channels in the membrane, and those channels have a special name in some cells, because some cells turn these water channels on and water channels off. They're called aquaporins. Aqua means water, and a pore is just a hole in the membrane. So cells can turn these channels on and off, and that's one way that kidneys regulate how much water your body loses, right? To produce a lot of urine, cells put aquaporins into the membrane very quickly. Water leaves your body, stored in the bladder, all right? But when you're dehydrated, those aquaporins are taken out of the membrane and water can't leave the kidney, can't leave your body. So this is one way that kidneys work to adjust water balance in your body. So going back, let's go back. So now we've moved the membrane over to the left. We can actually measure the amount of pressure now that has been developed by these solute molecules and by osmosis, the process of osmosis, moving this membrane over. We can push on this membrane to get it back to where it was, right? And that's what we call osmotic pressure. So here we have pushed the membrane back or prevented it from moving, okay? And, oh, this is actually another experiment, okay? That would be a way for us to measure osmotic pressure. But let's look at this slide right here. Different concentrations. Pure water on this side, fairly concentrated solute on the right-hand side. So can you see water is going to move from left to right, and in so doing, it's going to move the membrane to the left. But let's prevent it from moving by pushing in the opposite direction on this membrane. That's what we call osmotic pressure. Okay. So let's consider, let me flip a couple slides ahead. Okay, I'm going to come back to this definition right here. Okay, so this is pretty much the same. You know what? I can't talk about this right now. I'm going to give you a couple of, let's talk about this one, and then I'll go back two slides. All right, you're going to have to know the definition of isotonic, hypertonic, and hypotonic, and what's happening to cells, and then this will kind of clarify how important a topic this is. So let's start out with a beaker right here, and here we have a cell. And that looks like what kind of cell? That looks like an erythrocyte to me, okay? So that's our red blood cell. And the concentration of solutes inside this cell, as a matter of fact, pretty much all cells, is 0.9%. And I'm just going to put NaCl, but there's other solutes in there like glucose and potassium and stuff like that. So that, just an example. So if all the solutes add up to 0.9%, what is the remaining percent that's water? It is 99.1% water inside this cell, right? Okay. So let's put this cell in this beaker that is distilled water. And distilled water is, if it's any good, if it's really good, is 100% water. No solutes whatsoever. Right? And this membrane is such that sodium and chloride can't get out, but water can. Water can also go in. So what kind of membrane is that? Semipermeable, right? So what's a higher concentration, 99.1 or 100? 100 is higher. Does it look like it's a lot higher? It only looks like it's a little bit higher, but nonetheless, it's higher. So water is going to move down its concentration gradient from high to low. So water is going to do what? Move inside the cell. What happens to the shape of the cell when water goes in? It swells. And as a matter of fact, even though that concentration gradient is so small, it's going to swell so much that this cell is going to burst. It's going to blow the cell up. That's amazing that it will do that. And it will happen so fast you can hardly see it underneath a microscope. By the time you get it in the microscope, it's already blown up. So when we blow this red blood cell up, we call that hemolysis. What's lysis again? Yeah, lysis is what? Taking something and breaking it up into smaller pieces. Like a lysosome breaks down things, right? Lysis is just breaking things down. And hemolysis means it's the breaking of red blood cells. Hemo right here means blood. And so hemolysis is bursting the cell up. And what kind of solution does that? We got a choice of these three solutions right here. It produces a tension. This kind of solution we call hypotonic. That's a hypotonic solution. A hypotonic solution causes hemolysis. Got to have that on the tip of your tongue. So somehow you have to memorize that. But I'll show you how I do it in a little bit. Okay, what's another? We're going to do three different examples. Let's put another beaker, I guess, right here. This is good. And we got a cell. What's the concentration of solute inside every cell? 0.9%. Right? NaCl can't get through. Water is 99.1%. H2O. And let's put this in some concentrated salt water, like ocean water, and maybe put some more salt in it. And let's just say that we have a 5% NaCl salt solution. How much water do we have in this beaker in terms of a percentage? 95%. H2O. And, of course, water can go back and forth because, for instance, maybe there are aquaporins in this membrane right here. And now, which is a higher concentration of water, 99.1 or 95? 99.1 is higher. So which way is water going to go? It's going to move out of the cell. What's going to happen to the shape of that cell? It's going to shrink down, and underneath a microscope, it's going to look spiky and jagged. Right, so it's gonna look something like this instead of nice and round and smooth. It's gonna look spiky. Hopefully you saw something like that. Now what is that process of going from a normal cell to one that's all shrunken down? What do you call that process? Yeah? You learned that in lab?
Yeah.
Good. Crenation? That's crenation. And now how would we define this solution that this cell is in? We would say that is correct. Hypertonic. That's a hypertonic solution. So hypertonic causes crenation. And then our third case over here, we have that nice red blood cell, 0.9%, NaCl, 99.1% H2O. And we're going to mix up a solution, and we're going to be real careful when we do this. We're going to mix up a solution that is 0.9% NaCl and 99.1% H2O. All right, so we got the solution and the cytosol right here. What's higher, 99.1 or 99.1? It's the same. What happens to diffusion when there's no concentration gradient? It stops. So what happens to the shape of the cell? Nothing. It stays the same, right? So nothing happens to the cell. We call this solution isotonic. That preserves the shape of the cell. So when you get an IV, guess what kind of solution it should be? When somebody is putting fluids into your body, do you just hook up somebody up to a faucet and put in pure water? Or do you have to be, or do you got to sit there with a scale and measure all these salts and chemicals out? You got to measure everything out and make sure it's what? Isotonic. Because if you transfuse the improper solution to somebody, you're going to crenate cells or you're going to hemolyze cells. Neither one is any good, right? Because when you hemolyze a cell, what happens to it? It's dead, right? It blows up. Crenated cells won't function properly either, right? So in either case, you're going to be really hurting patients. Got to be isotonic. And you've probably heard of isotonic saline before. It's that specific concentration of all the solutes, right? Okay. All right, so think of a balloon. And you blow the balloon up, and it bursts. Can you ever get that balloon back? It's gone. It's irreversible. That's a catastrophic event, right? It's gone. Whenever you hemolyze a cell, right, you can't ever get it back either. Once it's blown up, it's gone, right? So that's irreversible. When you hemolyze a cell, that's irreversible. But what about crenation? If you have a balloon that's all blown up with air and let the air out, can you blow air back into it? Yes, you can. So crenation is reversible. I don't think we use this for anything in medicine, but if you're really dehydrated, right, you can rehydrate somebody and their cells will go back to their normal shape. Okay, so that's something different. And so, for instance, it's really easy to tell forensically if somebody drowns in fresh water as opposed to ocean water. It's really easy. Because if somebody drowns in a swimming pool or a bathtub or something, what's going to happen to the cells? Their blood. Water is going to diffuse in through their lungs and all their red blood cells. What did I say? Swimming pool? Yeah, swimming pool. What's going to happen to their red blood cells? It's going to turn, their blood is going to turn into just a red-colored Kool-Aid. No cells in there at all. But if they drown in salt water and you look at their blood, you're going to see what? All these spiky, jagged cells. Crenated cells. So the pathophysiology is totally different. Easy to tell one way or the other. All right. Can you overdose on water? Yeah, now you can see why. Right? Because if you drink a lot of water that's absorbed through your digestive tract, it goes into your circulatory system. And what's going to happen to the cells in your body? Right, if you drink a lot of water, water is going to go into cells. What happens to cells when water goes in? They swell up, right? You'll probably be alive before they hemolyze, but they're going to swell up. But there's one part of your body that can't get any bigger. What part of your body can't swell? If you drink a lot of water, your hands will puff up and your body will kind of get puffy and stuff like that. But there's one part of your body that can't get any bigger. Because, yeah, your brain, it's contained in that container. So when it swells up, the only way that pressure can be released is it gets pushed through the foramen magnum. So you can picture where that is, right, in somebody's head. And you know that happened to somebody not too long ago because there was a contest, some radio station was performing a contest or giving away a car depending on how much water you could drink. And it's really sad because somebody was really enthusiastic about winning that car and I think she drank like 2.5 gallons in a short period of time. And she felt really bad, probably started vomiting and everything. But they said, you know, you should really go to the emergency room because it's bad to drink that much water. And they even called the ER. And a nurse at the ER said, yes, come in, you can overdose. And we won't be able to help you and you'll die. Come on in. And she goes, Oh, I'll consider that, but that car is really important to me. And guess what happened? She died as a result of that. So yes, you can overdose on water. Okay. Water overdose is also related not just to contests like that, but there's been a couple cases because there is a drug that some people take and it gives you the sense that you're very thirsty, you're dying of thirst. All right, and I don't know if you've heard of this drug. It's relatively rare, but in the United States, probably 10, 15 people have overdosed on water as a result of taking this recreational drug. And that drug is methylene diamine methamphetamine. Anybody know what that is? That's ecstasy. Okay, so ecstasy stimulates your hypothalamus to think that you're very thirsty and you just drink and drink and drink. And so anyway, be careful with that. Okay, let's go to, yeah. Oh, thank you for reminding me. I forgot. But, okay, but I still remember. Okay. Even if I don't give this lecture in 30 years, I can still remember how they match up. And I'll tell you as long as you don't tell anybody I told you how to do it. Okay? I only have a black marker right here. I don't have a blue or red or something. Oh, here's something. Here's. See here? There's an E in crenation, and there's an E in hypertonic. And here there's an O in hemolysis. Now, don't laugh. There's an O in... I asked you not to laugh. There's an O in hemolysis, right? But you should understand the mechanism. You can memorize it that way, but of course appreciate the mechanism. But double-check your work. You should never get diffusion wrong on a test or crenation hemolysis wrong on a test. Are you going to have a quiz in lab today on hemolysis and crenation? Oh, that was last week. Oh, okay, well... Okay, last week. Okay, well, hopefully... You learned that anyway. All right, so let's go back to these two slides right here. So there are different quantitative ways that we can talk about the concentration of a solution. Oops, I went too far. Okay. There's something called a molar solution. There's something called a molal solution. And then there's even a third one that we call an osmolar solution. So how would we calculate these things? This might be kind of a minor point, but... I'll tell you anyway. A molar solution is when you take 1 mole of solute, which is what, like sodium or glucose or something, and you dissolve it in 1 liter of solution. So let's take some kind of fancy red. Let's take some kind of mixing vial right here that's calibrated. So this mark right here means exactly 1 liter of fluid. So how would you mix a 1 molar solution up? You would take 1 mole of solute, you have to measure it on a scale, and a mole is just 1 Avogadro's number of particles. And Avogadro was just a guy, why he called it a mole, I don't know. Right, but it's a huge number of particles. Does anybody know what a mole is? I haven't done this in 20 years. Yeah, times 10 to the, I think it's positive 23. Okay, because it's a huge number. Okay, so that's a 6 with 23 zeros after it, so it's a huge number. So if you take that number of molecules and you can calculate the weight of those molecules with a scale and put it in solution, you'd have 1 mole. But how would you do that? It says what? 1 liter of solution. So after you mix them together, it should go what? Exactly to this level right here. So you first put in the beaker, what? 1 mole of solute, and then you would add, all right, some water to what? To bring it to 1 liter, which means right to that mark right there. So depending on how much solute you put in here, you put different amounts of water just to get it to that mark exactly. That would be a molar solution. A molal solution, on the other hand, I got to erase this over here, okay. If we take that same beaker, here's the what? The 1 liter mark, exactly right here. When you make a molal solution, you put in 1 mole of your solute, and also exactly 1 liter of solvent. Oops. So if you put in 1 mole of solute and 1 liter of solvent, where does the fluid go to? It's going to go above this little thing, right? So it's going to be a little bit more. That's a different way of measuring concentration. And so you can't use those terms interchangeably. Do you think it matters? Because how sensitive are these cells to osmosis, right? Very, right? So you got to be particular in what kind of terminology you use. All right, so it says 1 kilogram of water right here, but that's an interesting thing about water. It's used as the standard. What is 1 kilogram? That's a weight of water. 1 kilogram of H2O, 1 kilogram of H2O is exactly equal to what? 1 liter of H2O. That's really the definition of that volume of water compared to the weight of water. Okay. So that's the difference between molarity and molality. Furthermore, we can talk about osmolality. What the heck is that? Well, we said that osmosis is controlled by the concentration gradient of water, and that is just what? The number of particles of water compared to the number of particles of solute that's in this compartment right over here. Well, some molecules, for instance, like NaCl, what happens to NaCl when we put it in water? Does it stay one particle? It actually breaks up into 2 particles. We call that dissociation. So NaCl is going to dissociate into 2 particles. So now the concentration of particles is actually twice what the molarity is, right? Because now you got twice as many particles. And what determines osmosis is the number of particles, not the concentration of sodium chloride, but the total number, the concentration of all the particles in solution right here. And that's a measure of osmolality. Okay, so if we put in solution of 1 molar, right, glucose in solution, glucose does not dissociate. So the osmolality is going to be the same. But if we put in 1 molar solution of NaCl, it's going to dissociate. So it's going to have a bigger osmotic effect compared to this glucose over here. Right? So the way that we calculate that is that we take the molality of the solution times the number of particles that are produced. And it produces, so we put 1 particle in, we get how many out of it? We get 2, so we got to multiply the concentration by 2. So the osmolality over here is really 2, okay, osmolar, because that sodium chloride dissociates. All right, so that's going to have a bigger osmotic effect, and of course, glucose and sodium can't move across the membrane. Water can move across, and it's going to push the membrane back and forth. All right, so 1 molal solution of NaCl will yield a 2 osmolar solution because why? Sodium chloride dissociates into 2 particles, 2 different species. Right? So it's going to have a greater osmotic effect. Okay. All right. Oh, this last term over here, I'm not going to talk about these unless I change my mind. Okay, isoosmotic, hypoosmotic. And this is just what we covered on the board so far. What causes, that's on the slide. Okay. Can I blank that out somehow? What causes this right here? What kind of solution? That's crenation. What causes crenation? Hypertonic solution. Right. Okay. Okay. All right. So controlling osmolality of your body is very important. Because what's going to change if the osmolality of your body changes? The shape of these cells. Right? If it really gets out of hand, the cells are going to blow up or they're going to shrink down. So it's very important for your body to regulate water concentration inside your body. So how does that happen? Well, you can undergo an activity like go to Burning Man and dance around in the desert and perspire like crazy. What's going to happen to your water balance? As your water is going to decrease. You're going to become dehydrated, right? All right, and when you become dehydrated, what happens to your blood volume? The fluid comes from your blood and you perspire it out, so your blood volume is going to decrease as a result. So your plasma becomes more concentrated. You lose water, becomes more solute concentrated, so the osmolality of plasma increases. So here we have a nice response loop. So how does a response loop always start? Stimulus. So decreased blood volume, increasing plasma osmolality is the stimulus. And in order for this to be a response loop, what do you have to have to monitor these changes or to be aware of these changes, for you to interact with that internal environment? You need a receptor, right? And there are receptors in the hypothalamus. We call these osmoreceptors that measure the osmolality of blood. And what else do you have in the hypothalamus after it can measure the osmolality of blood? So the hypothalamus is the integration center. What does an integration center always have? The set point. So there's a normal number for what the osmolality should be, but in this case, we know that it's going to be what? Depressed. So the hypothalamus makes a decision and says, you're dehydrated. How can we combat thirst? The hypothalamus is going to give you the sensation of thirst. You're going to drink water. And when you drink water, that's going to, of course, increase your water intake. And when you increase your water intake, that water is going to go into the blood. And is that going to add to or subtract from the initial stimulus right here? When you drink water, that increases your blood volume. How does it relate or how does it interact with the initial stimulus? Does it add to it or subtract from it? It subtracts from it. So what kind of feedback loop is this? Nice negative feedback loop. That's what? A kind of feedback loop that operates when you're maintaining homeostasis, right? It brings you back to the set point, or another way of saying it brings you back to normal. So that's one thing that the hypothalamus does. Another thing that the hypothalamus can do is that it's going to secrete a hormone. And that hormone is antidiuretic hormone. So there are neurons in the hypothalamus that go through the infundibulum. Does that ring a bell? That's the stalk of the pituitary into the posterior pituitary where the axon terminus is, and the axon is going to release antidiuretic hormone. So this is sort of interesting because ADH sort of looks like a neurotransmitter in this case, but it's being picked up by the circulatory system and delivered through your whole body, so it acts like a hormone as well. So here is a good example of a neurohormone. It gets picked up by the circulatory system, taken to the kidneys, where it tells the kidney to increase water retention. So what does that mean? All right, let's go back to ADH, antidiuretic hormone. What does a diuretic do? It makes you pee, puts you into a state of diuresis. It makes you pee, makes your body lose water. Antidiuretic hormone does what? Opposite of that. Makes you retain water. When we're going to talk about how it does it by manipulating these aquaporins that I had over here in where? The kidneys, so you retain water, right? So when you retain water, how does that relate to the initial stimulus? Add to it or subtract? Subtract. So both of these effects act with a negative feedback mechanism to bring you back to the set point to maintain homeostasis in your body, right? So here's just a classic kind of response loop. So don't forget response loop. Always think of what? Response loop always starts with a stimulus, always ends with a response. If the response subtracts from the stimulus, it's negative feedback, maintaining homeostasis. But don't forget about that integration center with the set point and the afferent pathway, efferent pathway. There are effectors. What would be the effector in this pathway right here? What's the effector? It would be the kidney. And the efferent pathway would be the circulatory system, taking that signal to the kidneys. And what's the name of the signal? It is antidiuretic hormone, ADH, from the posterior pituitary. So that's how you would analyze a diagram like this. I don't know if this is an exam figure or not, but it would be a good one to have. It would be a typical kind of exam figure you should check. The effector would be the kidney. The kidney is the effector. And ADH secretion, I guess, would be part of the efferent pathway. Okay, and then the response is increased water intake and increased water retention. That's the response. And that's going to either add to or subtract from the initial stimulus right here. Okay. Well, let's just look quickly for just a little bit on membrane transport systems. All right, carrier-mediated transport. Well, molecules that are too large or too polar, I can't go through, again, I don't have the picture of the membrane anymore, to diffuse through the membrane have to be carried across by transporters. And these are proteins. So these are protein carriers. And carrier-mediated transport has these different attributes. So you should think of all carrier-mediated transport by these three attributes right here. And that is, the first one is specificity. And that just means that a protein carrier will carry certain molecules, but not others. And you should know on what basis it can select some molecules and exclude others. So, all right, let me just draw it real quick right here. Let's just say that it's going to be able to move a molecule that looks like that. But, so there's going to be, so here's the membrane, and so here's the protein, for instance, that's going to carry it across the membrane. Well, guess what this little protein has to have? It's got to have a site in there that's going to be complementary in nature to this molecule. All right, so this one will fit in that little niche very easily. But if we have a different kind of molecule that looks like that, can that be transported by this transporter? No. Won't fit in this active site right here. So the shape has to be complementary. It has to match up. So that's what we mean by specificity. It will select some molecules, but not everything. And it selects it on the basis of what? Tell me. Shape. Basis of shape. Right. Okay. So that's the first one. Okay, competition. It also exhibits competition because, for instance, we could have a compound maybe that's intermediate between these two. Maybe we have a compound that looks like this, which is what? This one now can also fit in here because it's related by shape. It has a similar kind of shape. And if this molecule comes in right here, what about this one? It's excluded because this active site is now occupied, so it's going to exclude that. So that's what we mean by competition. These two will compete for this site right here because they have a similar kind of shape, right? All right. Well, as far as transport of this one molecule right here, let's just say now we put in another transporter, like this. Can you see in this condition where we have two transporters instead of one, that the rate of transport across the membrane could be, what, now twice as fast, right? And once we fill up the active site of all these transporters right here, right, once we fill up the active site with molecules that are being transported, what happens to the rate of transport? Even if we increase the concentration right here. If we put all the right kind of molecules, if all of these proteins are occupied, then the rate can't increase anymore. That's what we call saturation. When the transporters are saturated because you have a high solute on the outside, it can't increase anymore. So, and I'm going to start with this, remind me to start with this slide next time. This is just a nice graph of the rate of transport of some molecule that we're going to say X versus its concentration. And as we increase the concentration, what happens to the rate of transport? There should be a little arrow up here, meaning increasing. So the rate of transport increases until all the transporters are saturated, filled up. So even if we increase the concentration of the molecule, the transportation will not increase. So this level is what we call the transport maximum, or T sub M. All right, but I'll finish talking about that one next time, too. Okay, have fun in lab. What are you doing in lab today? Oh, yeah, don't lose them. You know, a lot of times I come to school in the morning and there's, like, mice running around. So careful with them.